Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls. We are happy to have back with us on the program once again this morning Dr. Claudia Nugent. She is a gastroenterologist with Christie Clinic. I mean, she's a doctor that deals with all the various parts of the digestive system and tries to help people who have a variety of complaints, things that we might well talk about having to do with digestion, ulcers, reflux disease. Certainly every time we do this show, we like to try to talk a little bit about colon cancer and the important things that people ought to know about that. And any and all of that is certainly open for questions. That's why we do these programs, to give people who are listening the chance to call in and ask questions. I also try to remind folks who are listening that we can't do diagnosis over the telephone because obviously the doctor can't see you. And if you have some real concerns, you want to take that up with somebody who can. But this is a place you can start. You can ask some basic questions, and I'm sure that she'll do her best to help you out. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-9455, 800-222-9455 at any point here. You have questions, give us a call. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.
Glad to be back.
I guess I thought I could start out just asking some basic questions about some of the basic things that you deal with. And I thought we could start with reflux disease, okay, since that seems to be, and we've certainly talked about this before, there seems to be a lot of it. And we know there are a lot of people who are taking medications for it. Probably almost everybody has experienced indigestion or heartburn at some point in their lives. But this is a maybe a little bit above what's just the average experience of a lot of people. How do you make a definition of reflux disease?
I guess the definition would be to have a significant, people use different terms, heartburn, burning underneath the chest, underneath the sternal area, often associated with meals. A burning area in the upper part of the abdomen. Often people will talk about a bitter taste in the back of their throat and even in their mouth, which is probably the most accurate for diagnosing that just by talking with people. And then, you know, whether it's significant or not, if how often are they having the symptoms, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Is that something that you – say you have a patient that has those symptoms – and they talk about how it happens and when it happens, and maybe it's in response to eating certain things, and you can gather enough information that way. If for you, is that enough to make a diagnosis, or do you actually and at what point, I guess, would you want to use the technology that you have to actually take a look and look inside and see what was going on?
Well, I think the reflux is extremely common, and as the American weight goes up, reflux problems become even more common. Really, most people that have reflux can probably be easily treated with over-the-counter medicines, and many people just self-treat, and as long as the symptoms are not constant and they're very well controlled with over-the-counter medicines, that actually is usually adequate. When patients come to the office and they have these what we call maybe warning signs of things that are a little bit more severe, such as symptoms that are not responding to medicines or they're marginally controlled with medicines, even prescription medicines. Prescription slash over-the-counter medicines are almost the same now that Prilosec is available over-the-counter. Mm-hmm. But certainly if symptoms are not controlled with those medicines, then that is a warning sign that things need to be looked into further, and that would be certainly an endoscopy potentially. If think people have swallowing issues where things are getting caught on the way down, that needs to be investigated.
Yeah. Other than weight, I'm sure that's one of the things for the very first time that you see a patient who has those symptoms, that and if that's an issue, then that one of the things that you're going to talk to them about is just that. Is say, well, we think that your condition could be improved if you lose some weight. So that's maybe one of the first things, one of the lifestyle things that you're going to talk to that person
certainly
about. But I'm sure that there are others that have to do with particularly the kinds of things that people eat maybe, but also alcohol use, tobacco use, other sorts of things that you'd say to the person, okay, these sorts of things – if you want to improve your symptoms, my suggestion would be do these things?
Well, you know, there are certain things. I'll start certainly with smoking. Smoking decreases the effectiveness of the medicines that control acid. And so when patients are taking the medicines, they're still not getting good control and they're smoking significantly. It's a problem. It's hard to get on top of those symptoms because the medicines just don't work as well. Smoking also increases the risk of esophageal cancer, stomach cancers, almost all cancers, and so that's always a concern. Alcohol in small amounts is not a major issue, but certainly in larger amounts, it has a direct caustic effect. It's like pouring, you know, alcohol on a wound. It hurts, especially if things are already irritated and it can't irritate by itself. It's tomato season, and tomatoes actually increase the amount of relaxation you have in the lower esophagus, and that can also increase the amount of reflux. Mint does the same thing. Coffee. There are coffee shops all over the place now, and certainly more than one or two doses of caffeine a day definitely can increase the potential for significant reflux.
So I guess I thought that with tomatoes, maybe the issue just was that they're acidic, but it's not just that.
It's not just that. Tomatoes, any tomato-based foods, ketchup, spaghetti sauces can all increase the potential for reflux.
Yeah, and there are maybe a few other things. There's sort of a list of foods. You mentioned mint is one that's often on the list. I think chocolate, perhaps.
Right. Actually, more because of the caffeine content.
So those are things that you can warn people about. Say, okay, look at your diet and look at those sorts of things and see what you can do to get those things out of your diet, or at least keep them to a minimum. Maybe
right.
People get to the point where they say, okay, I can tolerate so much, and then if I go beyond that, then I'm going to have problems. So you find out where your threshold is, and you try to keep
exactly.
It below
and I
that.
Usually try to tell patients, you know, we're all human. Small amounts are okay. Large amounts, expect to pay for that privilege. And so if you go out and you have that wonderful lasagna supper and you had some espresso after supper with a chocolate mint cake, guess what? You'll pay for it no matter what medicine you just took.
All right. Our guest this morning is Dr. Claudia Nugent. She is a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic. And we're talking about GI kind of issues. And I have a couple of callers here. We'll get to them in just a second. Let me give you our numbers. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. We'll start with our toll-free line number 4. Hello.
Yes. I had a little episode about 3 years ago where all of a sudden, just one minute I was fine, the next minute I had this terrible pain kind of my breastbone area. And finally I had my husband take me to the ER, and they determined that it wasn't my heart. And they thought maybe it was my gallbladder and ruled that out. And finally they said, well, maybe it's acid reflux. And I did have subsequent upper GI tests that shows I do have very bad acid reflux. And when I take Prilosec, it's usually pretty decent. I don't smoke, drink, or alcohol, or even drink pop or coffee, either one. So I rule those out, but I do like caffeine in the form of chocolate. But in my case, how often would you suggest I have an endoscopy, perhaps, to keep an eye on, to keep Barrett's at bay?
Well, how old are you?
I am 62.
Okay. If you do not have Barrett's at this point, you probably will never develop it. Barrett's usually develops at a much earlier age. It is a rare development, thankfully, from reflux, although reflux we do believe to be cause of Barrett's esophagus, which is a change in the lining of the esophagus as a response to reflux that may predispose, in rare cases, to esophageal cancer, and then it certainly needs to be followed along. It is a rare enough response that we don't have any firm recommendations as to who should have endoscopies to begin with and how often those should be done. There have been some numbers that have been thrown out there every 5 years, every 10 years, but we don't really have any studies that show that that really is very helpful or that it is at all cost effective. So I guess my caveat is if you have had an endoscopy and you don't have any Barrett's by now, you probably won't.
Okay, but I've never had one, so would that be a wise idea to have one for kind of a baseline?
There's no firm recommendations. If your symptoms are well controlled, do you have to have one? No. If you came to my office and said, you know, I'm a little worried, I would probably have a very low threshold for doing the exam because it's a very easy exam to have done. But there, I can't show you in a book or in a research paper that there are firm recommendations that you need to have one by a certain age.
I've had like a couple episodes of this. This was the first one, was about 3 years ago. I've had a couple episodes since then, but it's kind of the same thing. I'm fine 1 minute, and the next minute I got this terrible pain right there. But they've been of lesser quality than the original one. And so I'm, you know, I'm still don't know whether it's gallbladder or it's just acid reflux or what it is.
Well, a lot of times people, when, as a response to reflux, there's actually an esophageal spasm, and it's not as much the irritation from the acid. It is actual spasm that occurs in the esophagus, and that can feel like a heart attack. Heart attacks can feel like reflux, so you have to be very careful, as you were by going to the emergency room, to make sure it was not your heart. And that's always very important when we see patients, to rule that out, because obviously heart issues most of the time are a lot more serious than esophageal issues.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks. I think that's a good point to remind people that chest pain is not something that you should take lightly.
Exactly.
And there may indeed have been cases when somebody was having chest pain and they just said, oh, well, that's just indigestion. Well, it's the kind of thing that if you having those symptoms, it's a good idea to take them seriously and get them checked
exactly.
out. So you wouldn't want somebody who's having a heart attack to say, oh, no, it'll go away.
Definitely not.
And the other thing is that, for people who are concerned about the possibility that reflux would eventually end up being cancer, that of people who have reflux, a small percentage will go on to develop this thing called Barrett's esophagus.
Right, right.
And of those people, then, a small percentage would indeed go on to have cancer.
Exactly.
But then if you have been given the diagnosis of reflux and you're taking medication and you're managing this, what are the chances that any one individual with reflux is actually going to go on to develop cancer?
Oh, the chance is minuscule. And that's why it's so hard to make firm recommendations as to when an endoscopy should be done or should an endoscopy be done. And if you talk to 10 different experts, you'll have 10 different opinions as to what should be done and when and if it should be done at all.
Okay. We'll go on here. Let's talk with some other folks. Next up is Muhammad, line number one.
Yeah.
Hello. Yes, hello.
Yes, hello. I drink lots of coffee. I smoke. I eat lots of tomatoes. And I've never had acid reflux.
Well, you're very lucky.
I've never had it.
That's great. More power to you.
And I'm 75. So I just wanted to tell people that those are not, and I'm not overweight.
Yeah. Well, you know, not everyone that drinks lots of coffee, eats lots of tomatoes, or sucks on mints all day is going to have reflux. It is a weakness in the lower esophageal muscle that is allowing things to come up. And if you don't have it, that's great. That's great.
I just wanted to throw that in there.
All right. Well, I'm glad to hear that there are indeed people who can have all those things. And I guess we also would want to say that everyone doesn't have reflux, and maybe people occasionally would report having heartburn or indigestion, but that's, you know, it's an every once in a while thing. At the same time, it seems that the numbers of people who have reflux seems to be growing, and I don't know if that's because we have medications and people are aware of it or something's going on that we actually are having more of it.
Right. I think that it's probably twofold. One is that people through the media are becoming more and more aware, as the lay media talks about reflux being a cause of cancer, and then patients tend to present more and think about, well, yeah, I do have a lot more heartburn, or yeah, I do have heartburn. As we get older, we tend to have more heartburn as well. Certainly the advertisements on TV for all the medicine to control acid, how much of that is just having more patients present because now they're aware of the issue, mm-hmm. how much of it is simply because it is increasing. I think that's probably a twofold issue.
Mm-hmm. Next is Champagne, and this is line number two. Hello.
Yeah, concerning digestive problems, eating too fast or, you know, I think it's sort of common maybe among Americans that we don't chew enough, you know, that kind of thing. And what impact does that have?
Well,
on digestion, or is it, again, it depends, or some people more than others, or whatever.
Yeah, again, it goes back to some people are more sensitive to certain things than others. The most common issue I see with people eating too fast are that they don't chew enough, and so they get something stuck in their esophagus because it can't go down. And also, there's a lot of air swallowing, and so you tend to belch a lot. When you belch, that can actually force things up into your esophagus, acid being one of them. So those are probably two issues. It doesn't actually affect digestion because digestion, although a little bit occurs when you're actually chewing, most of it occurs in the stomach and in the intestines, so it doesn't affect that too much.
The other point is that sometimes with that big meals and all that kind of thing, going to bed too early, that's, from my understanding, is not too good either. Or is that true or is that a myth? Or
no, that's quite true. If you fill your stomach up with food and then you lie down, you're going to be putting a lot more force on that muscle in the lower esophagus. If it's already weak, it's just not going to be able to hold up as well. Even if it's strong, it's going to have more issues with that.
Okay, so. And then finally, this is to go to the other end. In terms of the polyps, in terms of the colon, do they, or is there maybe a whole variety of different kinds of polyps, that they actually develop slowly? Is that true?
In most patients, yes, polyps do grow very slowly, and we believe that between the time of formation of a polyp and the potential for cancer should be somewhere between 6 and 12 years.
Wow. Okay. Good program. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Let me ask another question, and I have other callers we want to get to, and perhaps people have seen some reporting about this recently, and that has to do with potential side effects of long-term use of one particular class of medications that are used to reduce acid, the proton pump inhibitors. And here we're talking about things like Prilosec,
right,
for example, and which now, as you say, is available over the counter. There are some others that are chemically very similar that are still prescription medicines. A lot of people who are taking them. Apparently, there has been some concern raised about whether over a long period of use, this may have a weakening effect on people's bones and that it might increase people's risk, in fact, of osteoporosis.
Right. There's a lot of issues that have been raised, but nothing's really been firmly proven in any studies. One of the first things that was brought up as to long use of proton pump inhibitors such as omeprazole, Prevacid, Aspix, Protonix, et cetera, was that in the original studies, the rats that were tested developed a rare type of stomach cancer called a gastrinoma and carcinoid. And so the original recommendations by FDA were that these medicines not be used for more than 2 months at a time. And I believe those recommendations are still there, although they have gone by the wayside. Although they may still be in print, that really is not recommended anymore because the rats were the only ones to get those cancers. And as long as you're not a rat, and you can talk about whether people if that's appropriate or not, then you're okay with even using them long term. And we have many studies that show that they're safe for long term use. When you have decreased acid, we know that there are decreased absorption of certain nutrients, and iron and calcium are better absorbed in an acid environment. No one has shown that iron deficiency anemias form in patients on long-term acid suppression therapies, but theoretically they could. There have been some studies suggesting that the decreased calcium absorption may predispose patients to osteoporosis and then, of course, fractures from that. The problem is that there was an association made in those studies rather than a cause and effect, and osteoporosis as reflux are so common that you're going to see them a lot in the same patients, and I think those studies are very flawed. So I don't think it's a bad idea to be taking supplements of calcium anyway as we get older. And if you are taking acid suppression medicine, I think it's a great idea as well because we just don't know yet. But I think there is a big question as to whether that is a significant cause of osteoporosis or potential for iron deficiency anemias.
Okay, good. So, well, then we'd also, though, want to underscore the idea probably that for people who do take these medications, you need to make sure that you're at least getting the recommended minimum of calcium.
Right.
And possibly you might want to think about a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, it's not going to hurt you unless you have an issue with kidney stones. Taking more calcium usually is very well tolerated.
And there's any other reason to be concerned about taking these medications for long periods of time. And here we're talking about, you know, 6, 7, 10, 12, 15
no,
years.
No, studies, especially in Europe, where they've been using them even longer than we have. And they've been used here for at least, oh my gosh, 15 years. There really have been no problems with any long-term use.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. And next we'll talk with someone in Champaign in line 3. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Okay, a couple of questions kind of on the both ends, as the other caller had mentioned. I had problems with GERD, with the reflux, less than 10 years ago. Got put on, got endoscopy, that whole thing. There were a lot of issues I had, but one of them was the reflux, and it was irritating my esophagus to the point that they could actually see it. So I got on the Nexium and took that probably for about a year, and then never had an issue again until recently. And so I started buying the big jugs of Tums at Sam's Club, and I figured it was time to have it looked at again. And they didn't find issues with the endoscopy, like any irritation as they had before. But as a cautionary thing, they did put me on Nexium. And I'm just wondering how I think that doctor says it's going to vary, but how long normally does the treatment, the last time I was on it was a year, but how long now are they really recommending you stay on it just to help you? Even if they didn't find anything, I still experience waking up in the morning with that bitter taste in my mouth, with my throat really hurting,
right.
Sometimes. And so I'm going to try and lose weight. And I don't only drink a cup of coffee in the morning, not anytime after noon and stuff like that. So I'm trying, but how long do you usually recommend it's on? Are you on something like that treatment? And so what's the thinking now? When could I get off of it?
Well, you did actually well for a long period of time, which is a little bit unusual. 85% of patients that develop reflux issues have them for the rest of their lives. And so most patients that get started on therapy, they stay on it. There are some patients that may be on it for a few months, a year, are able to go off and have no issues. But most patients do end up using these long-term or at least intermittently long-term.
So the fact that I was on it for a year may have helped to prolong the good effects, basically, or?
Probably not.
Okay.
There may be something that pushed you over the edge that first time.
Okay.
And whatever that was may have resolved.
Okay.
Certainly reflux is not always the same all the time. That can kind of wax and wane, as you know.
Okay.
So there may be sometimes was a little bit worse, sometimes was a little bit better, and that certainly makes it a little bit different as
well. Right, because I never really have had the pain, burning pain. It's always been my throat.
Yeah.
I know it's that valve thing, what they call it. And I was told at the time, and you might mention, I don't know if it's still the case, this is back, about 8 years ago, that they could do an operation of some kind to strengthen the muscle, or do something with that muscle. I don't know if that's still a treatment that's offered. I think at this point I'm not at that level.
Right.
But if you could talk about that, and then I'll ring off, and if you could also talk about, because on the other end of things, my family has a history of colon issues, and would you say what the recommendations are as far as having first colonoscopy, I think it's called.
Well done.
And then, all that kind of stuff. And then I'll ring off and just listen. Thanks.
All right.
Sure.
Well, thank you.
All right. Let me address the surgery for reflux disease. There is a surgery that can be done for reflux disease. In years past, it was done as an open procedure. It was a very large incision. It was really rough to get through the surgeries and recovery. And we didn't recommend it very often unless people just had terribly severe reflux that was not responding to medications. Now, our medications have improved over the years, just amazing just within the time that I've been practicing, which isn't that long, I don't think. But so we tend not to refer people for the surgeries at a drop of the hat. You really want to go through therapies. And also the medical therapies, if you respond well to medical therapies or at least partially to medical therapies, you have a better chance of doing better with the surgery. If you don't respond well to medical therapies, then there's a good chance that the surgery is not going to get rid of all your symptoms either. with the thought that maybe some of the symptoms are not even related to the reflux. So that's always very, very important to define. The surgery is called the most common is called a Nissen, N-I-S-S-E-N, fundoplication surgery. And they actually wrap the top of the stomach around the lower esophagus to make a permanent, tighter area. Now, this doesn't open anymore like your esophagus does, open and close. But it is being done laparoscopically now, and in the right hands, we're having very good success with it. So it's a much easier surgery to have done. In the right patients, they certainly do quite well. Those surgeries tend to last approximately 10 years in most patients, some people longer, some people less. So I think in middle-aged patients, they don't hesitate too much with doing those surgeries. I think with real young patients, they probably are going to have issues. They're going to have something redone down the road. But certainly those surgeries are available in the right patients. They're very effective and they're very good.
Okay. We're at our midpoint here. Let me just, for anybody who's listening, introduce again the guest, Claudia Nugent. She is a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic, and we are here talking a little bit about GI, various kinds of GI issues. We have a couple of other callers here, and I'm tell you what, I'd kind of like to do these callers, and I hope the previous caller wouldn't mind if we'd say, let's come back to colon cancer screening.
Sure.
in a second after we get to see what these other callers would like to talk about. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let's go to normal, line number 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I was diagnosed with Barrett's a couple of years ago, and I've been on Nexium ever since, and it's worked wonderfully for me, although I did fall this summer and break my femur, so I don't know whether my system was not processing calcium the way it should have been. But I'm going in for another checkup next month, and a couple of weeks ago on the WGN evening TV news, there was a health note, and a doctor was profiled who is freezing the cells off of the esophagus that might be troublesome rather than performing the surgery. And I was wondering if that's a legitimate approach to that kind of problem and one that I should discuss with my doctor should my condition have worsened when I go in for the next exam.
Yeah, this it's a therapy where they actually do burn the abnormal Barrett's of the esophagus with the hope that normal esophageal tissue will then replace that. And that is not commonly being done for routine Barrett's because so few patients actually proceed on to any cancer from that. But if there are precancerous changes that are occurring, specifically high-grade dysplasia as described by a pathology specimen, then that may be a therapy option. It's most effective and can be recommended in patients that have maybe a nodule that has a high-grade dysplasia, something that you can actually see and destroy that area, or people that have short segment of Barrett's where it's not the entire esophagus. People that have real long segments of Barrett's will develop strictures if you try to do this, and it is not recommended in those situations. So for certain patients, yes, that is certainly a great option. If your Barrett's is stable, it probably is not worth doing it.
My physician did recommend another acid reducer drug, but it was almost prohibitively expensive, so I asked him to switch to Nexium, and Nexium works fine.
Mm-hmm.
Is that other drug, which I can't remember the name of, would that have less effect on the calcium absorption in my system?
No. I'm assuming that was a proton pump inhibitor. Much like Nexium, all the proton pump inhibitors have about the same effectiveness and the same potential effect on any absorption.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
All sure. Right. Thank you. Urbana is next. This is line number 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
You said that tomatoes relax the esophagus?
Yes.
Okay. I have two questions. One, are there foods that constrict the esophagus that you could, like, eat at the same meal? And the other question is, does this relaxation possibly affect lower down on the GI tract such that it would cause diarrhea or constipation?
Well, actually, that's an interesting question. I am not aware of any foods that cause constriction of the esophagus that you could try to counteract that with, but I'm open if anyone else has some ideas out there. The tomatoes and the mint, they do cause relaxation, not just in the lower esophageal muscle, but also potentially in the small intestine, usually fairly mildly. I suspect that there may be some patients that have a very profound effect from those types of things and potentially could have diarrhea. Again, it depends on the effect in what area as to whether it would be constipating or a diarrhea effect. And very individual, I think. But usually the effects are not that strong lower down. That's a significant issue.
Okay. And let's take another caller here. This is someone in Champaign in line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I developed the acid reflux problem a couple of years ago, and the Prilosec has done a good job in reducing it. My question is about the question versus of drinking coffee versus tea. I drink just 1.5 cups, I keep measuring it, just for breakfast, whereas my husband drinks tea constantly. My question is, if I were to switch to drinking tea and absorb forever from drinking any coffee, would that reduce the reflux problem?
Depending on how much you drank, it might. Traditionally, tea contains less caffeine than coffee, but if you're making your own tea with tea bags or tea leaves,
right,
you could probably let it steep enough so that you'd have almost as much caffeine in the tea as the coffee. So it would be the amount of caffeine that you're actually ingesting.
Oh, I see. Rather than the essence of the coffee bean versus the tea.
Right.
All right. So even at 1.5 cups of coffee, I still develop the problem.
Well,
so I think. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Can you drink decaf?
No, I don't like decaf.
Okay. Well, I respect that. I guess being
I was
a coffee drinker.
New Orleans, so my mother brought me up on strong coffee.
Right.
But
right.
I'm willing to switch to the tea, and I wouldn't be drinking that much of it. I just wondered if that would be essentially more basic an approach to reducing the reflux.
Well, certainly, if you're making your own tea, you can control how strong the tea is, and
yeah,
you can decrease the amount of caffeine that you have in it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Well, we now have our lines clear. If there are other folks who are listening who have questions, give us a call. Our guest is Dr. Claudia Nugent. She's a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic, and we're talking about digestive health issues. If you have questions, you can call us 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, now let's go back, and I'm hoping that caller is still with us, and do a little basic talk about screening for colon cancer. What now are the recommendations for the basic things that everybody should have done?
Okay, well, they probably haven't changed in the last 5 years particularly, but currently recommendations are for the first colonoscopy to be done between 45 and 50, and probably close to 50 is fine for most people without any risk factors, and risk factors would be strong family histories, especially in first-degree relatives as far as the increasing the screening. So the basic guideline is for low-risk factor patients, do a colonoscopy at age 50, and if nothing is found, then every 10 years thereafter is considered adequate. And that's a recommendation given by the American Cancer Society and the American Gastroenterology Association and the Medical Association as well. So I think that's pretty much accepted. If you have polyps that are precancerous type, if you have less than 3 polyps, they're all than a centimeter in size, then you're okay to have another exam 5 years thereafter. If you have 3 polyps that are precancerous or any one of those polyps is a centimeter or larger in size, then at least in 3 years you should have your next exam. Now, if you have a family history of a first-degree relative in their 60s or younger, or if you have 2 first-degree relatives of any age that had colon cancer, you should have your first colonoscopy between 10 and 15 years prior to the youngest age, the diagnosis of that family member. And then if there are no findings, every 5 years thereafter. Now, there are some unusual situations where there are different recommendations, but I think that covers most patients.
Okay. And there is an easy, non-invasive test that I think probably the suggestion is periodically everybody should do. This is the test for blood in the stool.
Right. That has been used to try to indicate whether patients should have this done. It's unfortunately not a super sensitive or very specific test, and so you can often have a positive hemocult, as it's called, that shows microscopic blood in the stool. But it doesn't take much to turn those positives, and so we end up doing a lot more colonoscopies than there are actually findings because of that.
Okay. I just want to mention to people who are listening that apparently we're going to hear over the next hour or two be doing some work on our broadcast tower on the lights. So that means we're going to have to, I believe we're going to have to reduce our power. That means that some of the people who are listening to us, particularly if you're a long way away from Champaign-Urbana, you may lose us, and we're sorry for that interruption, but it's work that it is being done here on the AM, only on AM, and that apparently will not affect our HD signal. So if you're listening to us that way, that won't make any difference to you. But it should, we hope, not take very long, and if you do lose us, our apologies, but we'll get back as soon as we possibly can. All right. And again, our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Claudia Nugent. She's a gastroenterologist with Christie Clinic, and we're talking about digestive health issues. We have a number of calls, and again, we'll get in as many people as we can in about the 10, 15 minutes that we have left. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And I think next we will go to a caller on line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
First, I want to thank the doctor for the service, being there. I had a brother who's 74 and has just been diagnosed with acid reflux. And
all right, I think we're back here. This is WILL Urbana. This is Focus 580. And again, our guest is Dr. Claudia Nugent. So we'll get back here to our calls and back with our caller on line one. Sorry for the interruption there. Go ahead.
That's okay. Again, thank the doctor for doing this.
Sure.
I had a question, and it concerns my brother. I was talking with him the other day, and he's been diagnosed with acid reflux. But his voice has become very, very gravelly. The thing that worries me is that our father died of cancer, the esophagus. And I'm wondering if for that reason, and I didn't mention that to him. I certainly didn't want to scare him. But for that reason, do you think he should have further exams?
How old was your father when he developed the cancer?
70.
Was he a smoker?
Yes.
Okay.
My brother is not, and or hasn't been for 30 years.
Yeah. There are some very rare family genetics where there appears to be a predisposition to formation of Barrett's and esophageal cancer, but it's extremely rare. And I know that Mayo Clinic at one time was trying to recruit patients for those studies, but they're extremely few and far between. Smoking, again, significantly alters.
I think we're off again.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Smoking significant.
Pardon? Thank you very much.
Are you still there?
Hello?
Okay, I'm sorry. Again, we had a little interruption there, and I think that we lost the caller. I'm hoping that she is still listening and we still have enough sort of basic information
sure.
So about this particular case. So please go on.
Okay. Well, again, the father was at a later age when the esophageal cancer became an issue. He was a smoker and thus significantly decreased this, that this is a genetic issue for any other family members. Now, if their voice changes, certainly you need to make sure it's not just a reflux issue and that there's also maybe ear, nose, and throat evaluation of the vocal cords, et cetera.
And this can be a symptom of reflux. It can indeed have an impact
yes,
on your voice.
Yes, it can. Reflux certainly can sometimes go all the way up to the vocal cords and then cause hoarseness. And because reflux is so common, it's a common issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm hoping that helps. And if the caller would like to call back and ask some follow-up questions, she's certainly welcome to do that. And in the meantime, I think we'll go on, try to talk with the caller on line 3. And this is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I had a quick question about IBS. I was diagnosed kind of when I was in high school, so I was pretty young. And I problems with it for a while, and then, you know, I ate properly and did all the right things, and it seemed to go away. And then I was reading somewhere about people were saying, you know, they hadn't had an episode for years, and then, you know, they would have, like, another episode. And so I had a question about that, because I have, I guess, over the years had various episodes. Is it... I guess I always thought it was like a chronic problem that I'd always have, and then I guess I kind of thought, like, you know, maybe I outgrew it because I didn't have it all the time. So I guess that's kind of my question. Is this something that, like, can come back, like, once every 2-3 years, have a problem, and then go away and then come back, sort of?
Yes. As a straightforward answer, it's so different. You know, we say irritable bowel syndrome. Syndrome always means that it's a group of things that we don't understand, I think. So irritable bowel syndrome is a big black box of movement disorders or hypersensitivity of movement of the GI tract. And there's probably several different disorders in that little black or big black box as we describe it. Some patients tend to have chronic problems but respond to fiber or supplement therapies and just, you know, have a healthy diet type thing. Other people will have just periodic problems. And because it's a full moon or because you have a waning moon, I don't know sometimes. But it can be both ways, really.
Okay, so it is something I probably should keep track of pretty much for the rest of my life, just be careful with it.
Yeah, it's not something that's going to kill you. It's just going to make things
a
little bit more. Yeah, exactly. It's a hassle. And as a woman, because of hormonal fluctuations, which also significantly affect the GI tract, as you go through hormonal fluctuations, whether it's pregnancy, even menses, menopause, et cetera, that can all have significant effect on the GI tract and can exacerbate issues.
Okay, so that's pretty much my questions. You don't really outgrow it. You just
most people
deal with
don't.
It.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Sorry.
Great. Thank you
all right,
so much.
Thank you. And
bye.
Again, to another caller here. This is someone in Mahomet on line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have what I consider a quick question.
Okay.
I have a problem when I swallow chicken getting constricted. Now, you're talking about stretching the esophagus.
Right.
What's that all about?
Well, as reflux can cause irritation in the esophagus, and two situations often can occur most commonly. The first that we see most commonly is called a Schottky's ring, and it's a very thin web of tissue that develops as a response to reflux, and it doesn't even have to be an abnormal amount of reflux. That's a real thin web of tissue and can intermittently hang up food, and it's usually drier foods or bigger pieces of meat, dry breads, etc. We go in with the endoscope, and there are different ways of actually dilating or breaking up that that web. You can use a balloon dilator where you inflate the balloon and it disrupts the web, or there are tapered tubes that can be passed through the esophagus that also just stretch it out. And the other potential is also an esophageal stricture, which reforms just from scarring, from reflux irritation, and that is treated much the same way.
Well, it doesn't happen very often. should I have something done, you think?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because most likely you have a ring. The rings tend to cause very intermittent problems, whereas the stricture is a little bit more consistent. Problem is if you swallow something and it doesn't pass and you can't cough it up and it doesn't pass down, you can't even swallow your saliva. And that is really uncomfortable. And then we have to do an emergency endoscopy to try to remove that. And no one ever likes having that done or doing it.
So
it's better to take care of it prophylactically.
Even if it doesn't happen very often and I can sip a little tea and then it's okay, it's...
Well, yeah, because I wouldn't want you to call me at midnight because something wasn't passing through.
I wouldn't want to.
Okay. I don't wish that for you.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. Thank you. And to line number two for another caller. This is Champagne. Hello. Caller there? Well, okay, maybe not. Someone's called real quick. We can get him in here. I want to come back to something about you were talking earlier about colonoscopy.
Yes.
There are two different procedures, and the difference between the two has to do with how much you're looking at.
Right.
One that goes a lot further and looks at a lot more, and then one that doesn't go in as far but looks at the place where statistically most of the polyps are going to happen, or
right,
are nearer to the end. How do you think about, and how would you suggest people think about, which of the two kind of scopings they would want to have if they were offered a choice between the one and the other?
Well, it really depends on what's available. I think for most patients anymore, colonoscopies are pretty readily available. But one of the screening parameters that has been used is a flexible sigmoidoscopy, and that looks at the left side of the colon predominantly, where previous literature showed most polyps exist. And so if you had a polyp there, then you were then to proceed on to the full colonoscopy. Because insurance companies are now paying for full colonoscopies and because studies are showing that there are more polyps being found in the right side of the colon that, of course, you would then not see with a short sigmoidoscopy, most people are moving to screening colonoscopies. And then the recommendations are you can do them a little less often. Now, if you don't have that as an option, actually doing sigmoidoscopies in combination with the hemocult cards that we talked about earlier is still an option, but you do have to do this a little bit more frequently and have to follow up.
Yeah, okay. I guess one of the things that people may be concerned about is that the prep is maybe a little less pleasant. It involves doing a lot of purging, and also because the scope goes in further. Maybe people are worried about the possibility that there, you know, you could unintentionally, there could be an injury. You could actually puncture the intestinal wall, which you don't want to then end up with having to do a kind of an emergency repair surgery
sure.
on somebody.
Sure. Well, let me comment on the prep is no fun for everybody, anybody, but it's certainly doable for most patients, and there are different types of preps that are not available to make it a little bit easier on patients. Perforation is a risk for any endoscopic evaluation, for sigmoidoscopies as well as colonoscopies. It's probably a hair higher for colonoscopies because you're going up higher. Mm-hmm. But the risk is still very, very low.
One thing that maybe people have talked about is, or I've heard talked about, is a new kind of technology. This is almost like science fiction stuff, where you could have people literally swallow a little device that has a camera and
yeah.
that as it goes through, it takes the pictures and then comes out the other end.
I personally am waiting for the Star Trek thing that just buzzes on the outside of your body. But yeah.
Well, what do you think would be the potential for something like that that was less invasive, I guess, and maybe a little bit more comfortable, maybe not quite the level of risk?
Well, right now, what you're talking about is a pill endoscopy, where it's a small camera that's inside a pill, and you wear a monitor, and you swallow it, and it travels through your GI tract. That is actually currently only being used for small intestinal evaluation, and it's one of the better ways that we can look at the small intestine that we couldn't do very well before. I know that I believe in Japan they're starting to develop something potentially that might be able to be used in the colon as well. But you're still looking at a preparation with the laxatives because you do have to clean out so that you can see things. The sensitivity for that is probably never going to be quite as good as with the scope itself, and realize it's not going to be therapeutic. So if you have a high potential for having polyps because of a family history, or if you've had polyps before, you may be looking at that not being a very good option. Another evaluation type is called virtual colonoscopy or CT colography. It's not really virtual. It's actually just using a CT or an MRI type scan. Those are X-ray modalities that are becoming available to look at the colon. For the most part, you still have to go through a colon prep. Most insurance companies, at least in the Midwest and in the West, are not covering those exams yet. They do not report polyps less than 3 millimeters in size in most studies, and I need to really be done in the best hands. So those are probably not ready for prime time, but may become available for screening.
Well, I suppose that it is true that people need to remember that if you are in there with the scope, then and you see something that's problematic, you can then take a tissue sample.
Yeah,
or
exactly.
Even so, so then if you do one of these imaging things, then you see a problem later, you're going to have to go in there and take care of it. So
exactly.
I suppose in a way this has some advantages, even though it's maybe for the patient. It's not the kind of thing you want to have done every day.
Right.
Yeah. Anything, just before we go real quick, anything new on the ulcer field?
Probably not so much. As H. pylori becomes less of an issue, I think we're seeing more and more ulcers that are not H. pylori related. We always have known that there's been a subgroup there, but I think a lot of people are being treated for H. pylori in their primary care's office just with simple blood tests, et cetera. So we're seeing less of an issue with that. So ulcer disease is still out there. Many of it is medicine-induced from non-steroidal-type medicines, ibuprofen, Aleve, naproxen, et cetera. But there is a subgroup of patients that get ulcers without any obvious inciting factor.
Well, there we'll have to leave it with our thanks to our guest, Dr. Claudia Nugent. She's a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic. Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.